Well, hi there. You are listening to After Party Pod. I am your host, Anna David. This is coming to you from the After Party Chat Empire or Enterprise. Take your pick. You can find us at afterpartychat.com. Although, you know, you guys know, of course, if you're listening to this, you know things. So you know you don't need to put the www anymore. That's like for our parents, if not our grandparents. Anyway, we are a website that is all about addiction and recovery. It's sort of lifestyles of the sober and sometimes fabulous. And After Party Chat is you know, a subdivision of that. It's the podcast. And thank you for downloading. Please do be sure to check out the site. And if you like this podcast, by all means, tell your friends. Tell even your virtual friends, meaning the other people who might come upon this podcast on iTunes and want to know what you think of it. And that's what I've got to say. Today, my guest is Nick Sheff, who wrote the mega bestseller, Tweak. And it came out around the same time as his dad's book, Beautiful Boy by David Sheff, and the beautiful boy, the title references is Nick. Nick had a horrible, one of the worst addiction cases I've ever heard of, in terms of how far he took it, and, just a terrible addiction to meth, and he also did heroin and crack and all the ones, you know. And he ended up getting sober and is this insane success story. You know, he's married and he just wrapped up a season as a writer on The Killing, that show we all love. And he has his first novel coming out next year. And he is just a joy, and it is my great privilege to be his friend. I met him when I went to interview him a few years ago, and he ended up writing for me at the site where I was working, and he was just such a pleasure to work with. He's really unlike anybody I know. His natural sweetness is evident in everything he does. And so today I got him on the podcast. I got him to talk all about his addiction, where that took him. He's straight, but he became a sex worker with male clients. And he talked all about that and about what he needs to do to stay sober today. And he's just a great guy. So that's about to happen. I would like to point out that theme song you heard came to us courtesy of the fabulously talented Seth Rothschild. The instrumental version you'll hear at the end, also Seth Rothschild. And yeah, thank you so much for downloading, and we will see you next week. Now this is my guest, Nick Sheff. But I started this.
Okay, awesome.
We're being recorded, Nick.
Awesome, I'm ready.
We have never been recorded together, right? Because that would be weird, because, you know, we've hung out a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, we have, but, well, we have recorded ourselves.
First of all, I lied, because you have recorded me. Remember when you interviewed me for your dad's
book? Oh, yeah, totally.
Was I being recorded, or did you take notes?
Yeah, I recorded you audioly, definitely. And you recorded me when you first interviewed me, too, I bet.
Oh, my God.
Right? So we have been
Never have two people been recorded more than you and
true.
I.
Yeah.
So let's wait. Okay, so let's go back to that, because so I obviously became aware of you when Tweak came out. Well, and I guess first when I read Beautiful Boy, or when I read the excerpt in the New York Times.
Oh, right, yeah.
And I was so, because I'm from Marin, I was so intrigued. You know, who is this family? And
We went to rival high schools,
kind of. I don't think I knew that at that point. And then it all just blew up. And then years later, I was working at a website, and your second book came out, and I put in a request to interview you, and I was super nervous and starstruck when I first met you, and we had coffee at King's Road.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that, too. Yeah, and then you asked if I would be interested in writing on the site, which I totally was.
Yes.
And so then you were my editor for...
Then I was your editor for...
Like a couple years. Yeah.
And they were, you know, it was such a crazy place that I worked for, but yet that somehow, like, our whole thing never really got sullied by that.
No, it was fun to work with you. Yeah. And I remember we went out to dinner with, I think maybe the first time we went out to dinner with one of the
owners
of that publication. And I just remember having a really good time hanging out with you more than anybody else. And it was fun. And we got to kind of laugh at that experience.
That was kind of a crazy experience. Yeah, I think that's when I was told that, my friend reads your stuff and he thinks you're a bad person or something. It's like so insane. It was so insane. And it was like, I had, I guess, Munchausen syndrome. I don't know what you call that. That's not what I mean.
That's what Eminem meant. Stockholm syndrome, right? Yeah. What is that? It's like where you make your child sick intentionally, like in The Sixth Sense.
Yes. Or like Eminem's mother did.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, he has a line about it.
Yeah.
I thought it was okay because the mistreatment was everywhere, you know? Mistreatment isn't even a word, is it? Do I know how to speak English?
Yeah, you do. Also, I think that maybe that owner was better than the owner that was previous.
Hard to say. At first, though, maybe it seemed
that way. Like he was going to be an ally versus what had come before.
Yeah, so we survived that, and then, you know, just got to be friends, and you were so loyal to me. Like, you know, when I was let go, and I was still writing for them, you said to me, I don't want to write now that you're not there. And it was the most twisted, nice thing because I was going, no, Nick, write for them. I'm writing for them. I'm taking the money. You should take the money. And it was ridiculous,
I felt like what happened was going to happen, which was that when they let you go, that the magazine was going to totally fall apart.
Well, that's
and it did happen.
Well, I don't know the direct result.
I think that the two are connected for sure. You did a really good job, like just being a really strong voice for recovery, and brought a lot of cool people into the magazine.
But you know, it really meant so much to me. There were a number of people that said, I don't want to, now that you're not there, but you were the loudest, and you were the only one that I actually almost fought with about it, saying go do it. And it just, the loyalty just meant so much, honestly. And
besides just being my good friend, you've helped me out a lot too. I mean, you introduced me to the Kindle Singles guy, and I have been struggling to write a Kindle single for the last like 2 years.
But they're so short. Why are you struggling?
I know. Well, the one that I just wrote actually that got rejected was
rejected.
Well, I wrote this Kindle single, just a short story about my relationship with my dad, and it was really meaningful to me and stuff. And I sent it to him. And he read it, and he was like, you know, this is really beautiful, and, you know, you should totally send this to your dad, because it's a really nice thing for him. But basically, anyone who's read your books and, you know, knows about you and your dad is going to assume that you guys have this close relationship. So it's not necessarily, like, news to anybody. So,
okay, does it Kindle single have to be newsworthy?
I know. Well, he was just saying sort of he doesn't want to feel like I'm telling people
what they already
know. Story that they already know.
Right.
But the really great thing about it was that I did send it to my dad, and I hadn't told him that I'd been working on it, and so he read it, and it was very nice, and he said he cried and everything, and so that was a good thing that came out of it, for sure.
Well, the two of you, I mean, I don't mean to be like this, are really cute together, because that night that I had dinner with you it's like he's so affectionate with you, and he's so, you guys just really genuine, like, in addition to loving each other, you really like each other, and that's not something that I see with parents and kids that often.
I feel that way with my whole family. I feel really lucky, like my stepmom and my dad and my little brother and sister, like we all just went to Hawaii together. And
you did? I didn't even know that.
You didn't know that? Yeah. Yeah, I thought I told you that, but no.
I'm jealous. Is that why you're tan?
Yeah, I think that must be why I'm so tan, because we were on like a little resort all together, and it was super fun, but it was just amazing, like, to all be there as a family, and I think that's right. Like, we all really like each other so much. It's kind of a cliche, but I feel like they're like my best friends and everything.
It may be a cliche, but it's not a cliche that, like,
but it's real. Yeah,
that you really hear that, and especially I feel like you know, with addicts. And yeah. I mean, obviously there's like a huge relationship between trauma and addiction. And I find that almost everybody I know who's a sober addict has an extremely complicated relationship with their family, if not having suffered major trauma at the hands of their family.
Yeah. Yeah, know? That's true. That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I really admire about my dad and stepmom, and I mean, it's amazing that, you know, he wrote Beautiful Boy, and then he wrote this new book, Clean,
right.
That is just like this sort of really painstakingly researched, you know, comprehensive guide to addiction and recovery and everything. And for me, when I heard him speak about the book, it was so touching because it was like, you know, I had this problem, you know, I mean, I have this, you know, brain disorder, you know, this
right.
disease, and my dad cared so much about the fact that I was suffering from this illness that he just devoted his whole life to like researching it, finding out what the best treatment methods are, you know, finding out what it is in my brain that makes me act the way that I do and makes all addicts act the way that we do. And I just, you know, it's so touching to me that he cared that much about me to sort
right.
of change his whole career path. Because before that, I mean, he was writing about, you know, business and, you know, music stuff. And, I mean,
right.
he just wasn't interested in addiction at
right,
all.
Right, right, right.
So that was really meaningful to me.
I feel like I was with you when you had
yeah,
that
yeah,
realization.
Totally.
Because we were hearing him speak at...
Yeah, that was the first time I'd heard him speak for his new book. And, yeah, it was sort of like, whoa, this is amazing that... You know, he's done so much. You know, it'd be like if I had cancer and
right.
he just became obsessed with learning everything about cancer.
Well, but I... And you guys, the two of you, have come to sort of be, you know, the best case scenario for if your kid goes down that path, you know? And I know people, parents all over, look to him and to you guys as sort of a model for what can happen, because I think a lot of... kids don't come back from, I mean, how far you took it.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I mean, I was also really lucky. I mean, I was talking to somebody recently about this, which is that, you know, there was a certain point where my dad said to me, you know, I can't take your phone calls anymore. Like, you can't come home. I'm not going to give you any money. I'm not going to help you unless you get into treatment. And I was calling him, you know, totally strung out, like begging him to let me come home. And he wouldn't let me do that. And I think that saved my life because, you know,
right.
he didn't enable me to just, you know, sleep it off and then go back out again. But at the same time, you know, when he hung up the phone that day, I could have very easily taken that next shot and OD'd, or, I mean, a million horrible things
right.
could have happened. So we were super lucky, too, for sure.
Well, and I feel like... the other thing that I would say, you know, from where I sit, is unusual about your situation is that you guys were super, super close before all of that, you know, before the, you know, you started doing drugs. And like, I do feel like, and I've made this up, and I don't know that I don't think I've ever run this by you, but this is the story I've made up in my head, is... you know, most addicts are troubled kids and are mean and are angry and are all of these things, and they have really contentious relationships with their families, like mm-hmm. I did, and then sort of come to sobriety and realize, oh, the reason I was so difficult all those years is that I suffered from this disease and I was trying to medicate it and mm-hmm. all these things. Whereas I feel like you have been sweet your whole life, because like, you are the one person I know that like, I've never seen you be anything but sweet. Like, you don't have that edge that most addicts and most people have.
Mm.
So I have this idea that you were just this sweet, sweet little boy and then young man, and that's why it was so shocking what happened. I'm not saying it wasn't shocking when I became an addict, but I feel like it was really shocking in your family.
Yeah. No, I think that's true, because we were so close. So, because, like, I would go over to friends' houses, and, you know, we'd be in my friend's room for, like, in high school or whatever, for, like, a few days, you know, doing drugs and partying or whatever, and I'd never even see their parents. But for me, it was like, when I came home, you know, no matter what, like, my dad and stepmom were always, like, there, and they wanted to talk and watch movies and hang
right.
out. I mean, we were all like, we were very close, yeah. So I think for them, like, it was really painful to see me pull away, whereas for some of my other friends, you know, they just weren't that close with their parents, so it wasn't such, like, a dramatic break or whatever when they started kind of spiraling out of control or whatever. But I think that, you know, I definitely do have, like, you know, an edge to me, too. And I think that, actually, if anything, I feel like in some ways, you know, because I have such a hard time with, like, confrontation and with, you know, sort of stating my needs and stuff, that was actually something that initially I felt like drugs kind of gave
you.
Me. Yeah,
right.
Because, like, when I was using, I could suddenly, I felt like I could be, like, you know, stronger and be able to, like, you know, tell people no and, like, you know, stand up for myself more. And so it felt very, like, like freedom or something.
Right.
Like, I remember actually when I went to my first, I'm sure a lot of people had this feeling, but when I went to my first rehab beforehand, I was being interviewed by the woman, you know, the intake woman, and, you know, she was telling me about, you know, how these drugs were my problem and everything, and I was like, you know, the drugs aren't my problem, like, they're the solution, they're the best thing that ever happened to me, like, I'm able to finally, like, be, you know, strong and state my feelings or whatever, you know, in a way that I never had before. So getting, you know, now that I'm sober, it's like, that's something that I still struggle with, is learning how to have, like, a voice in sobriety or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like I've gotten better for sure.
Right.
But, you know, I still struggle with it.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, because, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I always see you as just, like, so sweet. And even, like, the work situations where we together have had to deal with some sort of difficult personalities, like, I'm just going, oh, I wish I could be more like Nick and just sort of roll with the punches and not get offended and upset, you know?
So yeah, I mean, I think I do. I just keep it, I just hide it better.
Yeah,
or
real well. Really well. So, okay, so just let's go over, like, really what happened. So it's like, you started smoking pot at what age?
I think I started smoking pot when I was 11, and drinking when I was 11. And, you know, I think, you know, I had that experience when, especially when I feel like when I smoked, the first time I drank, I got so drunk that I threw up everywhere. So
right.
That wasn't an amazing experience. But the first time I smoked pot, I really felt like, oh my God, this is the answer to my problems. Like, I felt much more confident. I felt like, I belonged. I felt like I could sort of talk to people in a way that I never could before. It really felt like sort of the thing that I'd been missing. And once I started smoking pot, I smoked pretty much every day, like all through high school, especially like towards the end, like senior year. You know, I'd wake up first thing in the morning and start smoking pot, and I would smoke all day long. And really, I think the reason that I started doing harder drugs was because at a certain point, like, it didn't matter how much pot I smoked. Like, I could
right.
just be smoking pot all day long, which I was, and I wasn't getting that same sense of relief or whatever. So I decided to kind of try something else, like, what else is going to make me feel
right.
that way. And so, you know, I tried coke and ecstasy and you know, pills or whatever, and all those things. I liked all those things, but
right.
it really wasn't until I found crystal meth. Yeah, that was like the one that really was like totally the answer to what I'd been looking for.
And so you tried it when you were like how old?
18. I tried crystal meth, and from the moment that I did it, I think that I was completely addicted to it. Like, that feeling that it gave me that first time was so intense and so, I mean, I remember, I mean, I've written about this, but I think
right.
I really said, like, I wish I'd been breastfed on this,
because right.
this was the thing that I'd been needing my whole life, and my life spiraled out of control super fast once I started taking
right.
it.
Right, and so then you started, and then you got kicked out of your house, well, you dropped out of college.
Yeah, I dropped out of college. I got kicked out of the house. I was, living, you know, first I was living in a friend's, like, garage in San Francisco, and then I got kicked out of there, and so I was living in a park in San Francisco, and I was stealing and you know, doing terrible things to make money. You know, I was a sex worker for a little bit of time in San Francisco.
How did that start?
I guess, you know, it's interesting. I feel like the whole, like, sex worker thing is so exactly connected with, like, my feelings of insecurity and, like, self-hatred and everything. Like, I guess I always felt so, like, I just really hated myself. And so, you know, I felt like drugs were going to make me feel better about myself. And I also felt like being wanted by
right.
people was going to make me feel better about myself. And I mean, I, you know, I was always straight. I mean, I couldn't help that, you know,
right.
And, but I didn't get the same, like when I would walk down certain neighborhoods, the street of certain neighborhoods in San Francisco, like I would get attention, you know, in a way that
you never
was
had
very,
or...
yeah, it was very flattering to me. And so, you know, when
so like in the hate, basically, or somewhere
in the
like
Castro,
in the
yeah.
Castro. Yeah,
yeah, when I was 18 and I would walk around the street there, like I would,
and men would sort of be whistling, like what would happen?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, not whistling at me, but like, yeah, like catcalling me. But,
right.
You know, people would come up to me and, you know, ask me out. And, I was, you know, even propositioned, which is basically how it ended up happening.
Oh, so somebody comes up to you and they say, hey, I want to have sex with you. How much? Or
yeah,
something.
Basically. I mean, yeah, not like it wasn't quite as extreme
right.
as like let's have sex right away. But it was yeah, it was along those lines for
right.
sure. And then I, you know, would just go. I mean, basically, I'd just go into like gay bars in San Francisco, and you know, just sort of wait for someone to come up to me.
But how, okay, this is not the really the point, but
yeah.
I'm curious anyway. How would you communicate that it costs money?
Oh, well, I think it, I don't know, it just always was sort of, I think it was the people that were propositioning me, it was sort of
understood
yeah.
Okay.
I mean, because I guess, I mean, I was obviously homeless and
very young.
And very young, and, you know, doing drugs. I mean, a drug addict, like a hard drug addict.
And you would say that up front, or?
I think that I,
it was
know,
obvious.
I was obvious, yeah. And so it was like, well, you know, all right, well, I need, you know, this amount of money, you know, and I need you to buy me drink and get me food or whatever. And I mean, because I wasn't even 21, so I would
right.
Have to, like, sneak into these bars and
right.
stuff. And then
right.
in New York, too, it's that crazy, weirdest thing, was that when I was doing all this in San Francisco, I pretty randomly ran into, like, some old family friends that were visiting San Francisco that were kind of this wealthy family.
Yeah,
and
you wrote about them in Tweet,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, just, like, the son, it was a mother and her son, and he saw me and was just like, oh my God, like, you know, what have you done to yourself? Like, it'd been years since you'd seen me. And, you know, I was, I mean, I barely probably weighed 120 pounds or something. I mean, I was super skinny and just messed up. And so he was like, you know, if you come with us right now, like, we'll bring you to New York. You can detox in our apartment. You know, I'll get you a doctor and, you know, you can, I'll get you a bunch of pot. You can just smoke a bunch of pot and, you know, you'll figure out your life or whatever. And, you know, I don't know. I think if it had been, like, if he'd said, like, I'm going to take you to rehab or whatever, I wouldn't
right.
have gone. But because it was, like, he was kind of this cool guy and it
right.
seemed like, you know, cool, I don't know, whatever. It just seemed more palatable to me than, like, going into rehab. So,
definitely.
Yeah,
going
definitely.
Going to a nice house.
Yeah, going to a nice
house
and smoke a lot of pot. Yeah. So I think I like disappeared for a couple days and like just did a ton of drugs, and I showed up. They were staying at the Four Seasons Hotel
right.
in San Francisco, and I think the night before I had like gone in a crazy meth craziness, and I'd like chopped up my backpack. And I have a tendency to do this. So it was like, I had like a camping backpack and another backpack, and I like chopped it all up, and I was gonna like sew it all together
oh
to make an amazing bag.
You were way too resourceful on drugs, and like your head was bigger than your stomach, or whatever.
Yeah, I could not. So anyway, so I just had no bag, so I had all these clothes that were totally stupid. I don't even know why I needed to bring them anyway. But I got a laundry shop, a laundry cart out of a laundromat, and I stole it, and I brought it to where the park where I was living, and I put all my stuff in this laundry cart, and I wheeled it down Market Street to the Four Seasons, and I tried to go in, and the big bouncer bodyguard people were like, "You are not coming into this hotel." And I was like, no, I'm here to see these guests. And, they told me no again. And then they asked me who the name was of the people that I was going to go see. And they are sort of famous people. So I just knew, like, when I said their name, they were going to just think I was totally crazy.
Right.
It was, like, these very well-known people.
Right.
So I said their name, and they were like, "No, like, get the hell out of here.
Right.
You know, we're going to call the cops or whatever." And I, like, begged and pleaded them to let me in. And finally, you know, I think someone from the reception desk came out or whatever, and they called upstairs, and they let me come in. And so then a few hours later, we flew out to New York. They eventually set me up in my own apartment there and everything, but I hadn't done anything to work on myself or
And they were communicating with your dad?
Yeah, actually my dad, they were, but my dad was like trying to get them not to do
help
that.
You.
Yeah.
Right.
So they went against his wishes.
Wow.
But so then when I was in New York, then I started basically just doing everything all over again, and ended up getting, when I was doing the sex working thing, I ended up getting beat up super terribly bad. And,
how, what happened?
You know, I don't 100% remember, but I was with this one guy, and then another guy came that I think was like his boyfriend or something. And,
right.
I tried to resist them, and they didn't
that's so scary.
Want me to leave, and so they got super beat up.
By both of them?
From what I remember, and then I remember, like, they left me alone for a minute or something, and they had, like, this GHB vial, uh-huh. And I was like, I just want to get away from here, so I just drank the whole thing, and then the next thing I knew, I woke up in the emergency room, so thankfully they called the...
Which is amazing that they did.
Yeah, it was amazing that they did.
So you overdosed on GHB, basically.
Yeah, but I also had, like, broken ribs, and my, like, you know, eye was all swollen shut, and I was, like, bleeding internally, and I was super messed up. But, I think what they literally did was they, like, threw me out on the sidewalk, basically, and called,
right.
Like,
'cause they would have gotten in trouble or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
Ugh.
But then, after that, basically, I was able to get into treatment from that moment on, and, you know, I relapsed again after that,
right.
But that was kind of the last, like, really horrible experience of that type that I ever
right,
had.
Right,
that was sort
right.
of a wake-up call to me to, you know, be more careful with myself in the future.
And so then you got sober, you came out to L.A., you were in a sober living. You got in a very serious relationship that might have been a little, like, self-destructive.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I think that was sort of the end of that world, like, getting beat up like that in New York. And so I came out to L.A. and, I was sort of really working the AA program. And,
yeah.
You know, I'd been sober for, like, a year and a half or something. But I think, again, you know, I was doing more work on myself, but I still hadn't totally learned how to, like, love myself and how
right.
to, accept myself for who I was. So when I had the opportunity to get in this relationship with this woman, I felt like she was someone that I felt like, God, if she were to really love me and
right.
want to be with me, then that would really make me feel good about myself, finally. But unfortunately, she was secretly doing drugs still, which in retrospect, like, I'm such an idiot that I didn't know, like,
right,
she would be
obvious.
It was so obvious. Like, I remember I'd wake up in the middle of the night and she'd be, like, locked in the bathroom for hours, and I'd be like, what are you and she'd be like, oh, I have asthma, like, I'm using, like, a nebulizer or whatever, I don't want to wake you up. But it was, like, every night, and Anyway, it turned out she was, like, smoking crack, and so I started smoking crack with her, and we ended up, like, that was sort of the, like, if that period of time in New York was sort of the most, like, sort of self-destructive, kind of, like, with sex and drugs and everything, like, this was the most destructive period with just, like, pure, like, we were using so many drugs, like, such huge quantities every single day, you know, shooting everything to the point where, you know, my body, like, literally, like, started to shut down, and I, like, was, you know, like, my insides basically stopped working, and, I was just so, so, sick, and, you know, I probably would have ended up dying with her, except for that.
You're both still alive today.
Yeah, we are both still alive. And I mean, I think the thing that saved us, weirdly enough, is that I tried to, at a certain point, my mom lives in LA, I tried to break into her house.
Right.
And to get this computer, and I got caught when I was there.
Right.
And they, you know, police officer showed up, and they're basically like, you can go to detox, or you can go to jail. And so I agreed to go to detox because I didn't want to go to jail.
Right.
And she got into detox, you know, the next day, I guess. And I don't, you know, I think we both have relapsed since then, both of us, but that was really like the end of the, you know, it
yeah.
never got that
and
bad
I don't
again.
Know her well at all, but
yeah.
it's like,
I don't, yeah,
from
I don't
what I can tell
anymore.
Through Facebook and stuff, like, she seems to be,
yeah.
you know, doing you can never tell from Facebook
yeah,
anything
yeah.
but like you know whatever you guys are neither
yeah.
of you are doing what you were doing
right no totally yeah 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 she's alive and I'm alive and everything
yeah.
and you know living our living really like living
yeah.
real life yeah
and so you and so then you when you actually really took to sobriety a lot of your story is about like accepting that there was a mental illness as well, the sort of dual diagnosis.
Yeah, that's true
thing.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was really another reason that I really look up to my dad is that you know, he struggled with a lot of not ever with substance abuse stuff, but he struggled with a lot of like self-esteem issues and, you know, I mean, he had an affair on my mom and you know, was in some really terrible relationships and stuff and you know, when I was growing up, it was pretty, like, tumultuous for a while, and then he made the decision at a certain point, like, he was gonna get help, and he, you know, started going to therapy really regularly, and he got on medication and everything, and I could really see the way that his life, like, completely turned around, and, you know, he married my stepmom, and they have this really amazing relationship, and so it was a cool example of, like, how when someone makes a decision to change and does the hard work to change, that it is possible.
Right.
And so I sort of felt like, okay, well, maybe I can do that too. So I started going to therapy, and yeah, when they diagnosed me with having bipolar disorder, you know, it totally made sense. Like when they listed like the symptoms or whatever, and it was like, yes, 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 yes. Like I, you know, 100% like agreed with it.
Right.
So I went on, yeah, the medication, for it. And yeah, you're right. I mean, it was, there were a few periods of time where I was sort of like, well, maybe I don't need the medication or like I feel better now so I can stop taking it. But what I've come to understand is that like, in order for me to be okay and happy and living a good life every day, like there are these things that I have to do every day
right.
to make that happen, and I have to keep doing them. And you know, it's just like anything else, like you have to work a job, you have to, you know, do the dishes, you have to.
So what are those key things for you? Taking your medication.
Yeah, taking my medication for sure. You know, still going to therapy. You know, for me, I feel like I've had to really just come to accept like who I am as a person. And
right.
you know, I always wanted to be like someone that was really social and that had a lot of friends and that was like the going out to parties all the time.
It is
and stuff.
Impossible to get you out.
Yeah.
I know this from experience.
Yeah, I feel like I've had to sort of accept like, okay, like what makes me really happy is like
being home.
Yeah, writing, like being
right.
with my wife, like, you know, watching movies, you know, taking my dogs out. Like just sort of these simple things that, you know, I guess if I was 5 or 6 years ago, I would have looked at myself now and been like, what a loser. Like, you know, he's not cool at all. But for me, you know, I feel like that is what actually does make me happy.
Right.
And being close to my family and, you know, also sort of the whole spirituality thing. I mean, I think that's something that I, struggle with, but I definitely, work towards having sort of a connection with the whole higher power, whatever.
Well, it to me, it seems like that comes, your walks with your dogs is very spiritual for you. I mean, that's sort of the sense I get, that's part of it. It's, if it's not so much getting on your knees and like, you know, doing a prayer, but it's more.
Yeah. And I like meditate kind of like when I'm walking, like I'll like, you know, try to like, sort of ground myself and, you know, kind of get present and where I am and look around and be like, you know, wow, like it's really beautiful here and, you know, this is my life and I feel so much gratitude and stuff for everything that I have now in my life.
Well, yeah. And so, and then pretty exciting career stuff started to happen. I mean, obviously you wrote Tweak and it was this mammoth bestseller, which you couldn't have expected.
Yeah, no, not at all. And it's cool. I mean, it feels like people are, it's like, you know, I think like in high schools and stuff, like because it was like a YA book, it's like, you know, I think it's like a thing that kids are reading. It's like,
oh, I'm sure. Do you know how many curriculums it's
no in? But I mean, I think it's you know, there's like Go Ask Alice was like the big book about
that frightened the shit out of me when I was a kid.
I know, I had, you know, I had no idea that it wasn't true. I was like,
oh, it wasn't?
No, it's not true. No, I mean, everyone, it's not, everyone knows that now that it's not
true. All I just remember, I don't really, I just remember that it was scary.
And sad because she dies at the end.
She dies at the end. Okay,
but then it turned out that it was all like some, you know, it was all a hoax or whatever.
Right.
Not a hoax, but it wasn't a real story. But anyway, it feels like, you know, Tweak now is like, you know, kids are reading that in that same way, and it's really, it's cool. And then I just finished writing my first novel, which is very exciting. And Anna, you actually helped me with that because you gave me...
But I didn't... I mean, it's amazing that worked out.
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's really my friend Sherry's credit. That's,
yeah,
you know?
But you introduced me to her.
I introduced you to Sherry, and she's really smart and
she's a really good editor, and she helped me edit it. And she introduced me, actually, to the editor that is the actual editor
at
Penguin that is doing it. Yeah.
And Sherry sold her novel, by the way.
Oh, she did. Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Another one.
That's great. I need to email her and let her know what's going on. Cause it just got like, you know, I knew, but anyway, it just got accepted, like finally accepted, everything done. Yeah.
What's the release date?
Not till, fall 2014. I don't know why it
because
takes
they need
so
a
long.
Lot of time to amp. I'm just kidding, do you remember that?
Yeah, that's
we were
right. Yeah totally. I know they really want to amp me up, like,
yeah, because they're gonna spend every minute until then. No, but I'm sure actually it is true in your, and that's not, wait, hold on, that's,
it's
a year
that
from
far.
Now
it's a year from now.
Yeah.
I mean, it is weird that it takes so long, but I guess I don't know, you know. But he did say, he actually I talked to him the other day and he was like, I want you to I want you to be a media whore for this. And I was like, oh, okay. That's
you were a media whore for, I mean, it's a terrible word.
No,
especially
it is.
When you're trying to perform a sex worker.
I know.
But no, but I mean, Tweak, you got everywhere.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, and,
yeah, no, crazy, like Oprah and everything, which is so funny because that, that's like, it seems like, I mean, I just, it was such like a whirlwind that it doesn't even feel like it all really even happened.
And you weren't really committed to sobriety.
No, that's true. That's true. I wasn't. I mean, I was, but I was committed to it. I just wasn't successful at
it.
I wanted to be sober.
As far as you knew you were committed to it at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing, and it's sort of, you know, hard, I feel like, is that at a certain point, you know, like as an addict, I wanted to be sober and I just didn't know how to be sober, you know, and that was so painful for such a long time, you know, because in some ways when I was younger and it was like I never even had the concept of like wanting to be sober, then at least that, you know, it's like they say that, you know, AA ruins your drinking or something. It's kind of like that once you kind of realize, like recognize in yourself, like, I'm an alcoholic addict and I have this disease, then it is so painful to continue to keep relapsing, you know, knowing that what you're doing is wrong, like having no illusions that, you know, you're right. a normal person. It really, it's like really devastating. So I remember feeling that at the time, that it was like, I wanted so badly to be able to stop and I just didn't feel like I could.
It's interesting. I was just talking to somebody this morning about how people, you'll hear people say, yeah, you know, it's like I could quit drugs and I don't even have to go to those meetings and I can drink, and they're really proud of it.
Yeah.
As if that's some great, you know, that's some great accomplishment. It's like, yeah. you know, and you know how I feel, the meetings are what bring me the joy.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's if you're an addict and you're drinking, I mean, again, it's like that expression, you know, a head full of AA and a body yeah. full of booze is a horrible combination.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know some, like my friend, I have a really good friend, Max, who, you know, I was in treatment with, and he was a heroin addict, and he doesn't do heroin anymore. He drinks occasionally,
right.
but I think maybe we've talked about this before, but it does seem like there are people, like, I actually have another friend who is very similar. It's like, there are people, I think, who have become addicted to a drug, and then they end up getting
yes.
off that drug, and that was their problem, and then they're not, like, alcoholics with the disease
right.
of alcoholism or whatever, whereas for me, like, I feel like whether it's alcohol, and no matter what substance it is, like,
right.
it triggers that response in me, that, you know, phenomenon of craving or whatever.
Well, I think it's also that there's no test that exists that says you're a heavy user
yeah.
and you're an addict, or what's, you know, when are you dependent on a drug and when are you addicted? You know,
right.
you do an addictive substance enough times,
right.
you're going to become addicted
yeah, exactly.
to it.
Right.
Does
Especially
it change?
Like a heroin. Anyone can
right.
become addicted to heroin, but that doesn't
right.
mean that they have that, like, genetic whatever, you
well
know.
And the way of thinking that
yeah.
does require something if
right.
you're going to take that drug
yeah.
away.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's totally yeah. I mean, I feel like someone heard when they talk about, like, addiction being a brain disorder, I feel like that really resonates with me, because I mean
yeah.
it is a disease, I totally get that, but somehow that seems, because it's like, yeah, it's like there's something in my brain that is wrong.
Why do you think it makes people so mad?
The disease thing?
No, that's called a disease. I mean, that just enrages
yeah,
people.
Yeah, I know. Even, you know, for my dad's book, he said that was the thing that sort of surprised him the most, is when he was, you know, going on these talk shows and stuff, that people really have a violent reaction
Why?
To that.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, I guess because people feel like someone, I guess because it comes down to choice, so I
right.
feel like people think that someone, you know, who has cancer, like, they don't have a choice, they have cancer, whereas they feel like someone who is a drug addict, like, they're making the choice to put the drug in their body.
Right.
So that's why, for me, you know, understanding it as, like, sort of a brain disorder, a psychological, I mean, but it's more than psychological. I mean, it's a physical, you know, malady or whatever.
Right.
But somehow that makes it, like, a little less sort of, like you're saying, you know, there's an element of choice to it, of course. Like, you know, I have this disease. It's not active right now. But if I were to go, you know, take a drink, like, I would activate it. That would be my choice.
Right.
But once I take that drink, then it really becomes not my choice anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that really is.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it's subtle. I mean, that's the thing, I guess, also, is that people really like, you know, things to be black and white. And when something, you know, takes a little bit of nuance in order to understand it, you know, people have a hard time with that or whatever, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. So, okay, wait, this was awesome.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now there's more.
Okay.
Okay, so the game that we play on this podcast is, you could call it a game, or you could just call it me asking an impossible question.
Okay, all right. I might know it, though, if it's about that show you're talking
okay,
about.
Okay, so which episode of My Strange Addiction is fake? Do you used to watch it?
No, I have watched it, though. Yeah.
I think you're the first podcast guest who's actually seen the
show.
Seen
it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw Well, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Now, I was coming up with a new one for every podcast guest, but then I realized something, which is that I can just ask you the same one I asked my last guy. Exactly.
What they said or what.
Okay, so which was not an episode of My Strange Addiction? One, the woman who chews on electric cords.
Okay.
Two, the woman who eats drywall. Three, the woman who lives as an adult baby.
Oh, God, that's a hard one. A little
overconfident, my friend.
Yeah, I was a little overconfident. You know, I think the electrical cord one is the one that I'm going to say is false.
Wait, I'm having this moment where I can't remember. Wait, I think I'm losing it because I think that that is the false one. And now I'm thinking that on the last episode, I told my last guest that was the drywall one that was
fake. Well, maybe that is it, but I feel like I feel like the drywall
adult
one
is baby, I guarantee.
Yeah, that one's real. Yeah.
No. You're right. You're right.
Right?
Yes, because drywall, I wouldn't even know that term.
No, I saw one where they were eating couch cushions. I'm serious. And toilet paper. Well, a different person. One person was eating couch cushions and another one was eating... Yeah, that show was, like, funny to watch for, like, 1 second.
I gotta get better at this game so that I can remember. But I think you got it, so congratulations to you. Yeah.
Awesome. I think that's kind of depressing, actually, that I know what that show is. Well, just the one with the toilet paper was so funny because the mom was, like, yelling at her all the time. It's like, stop eating that toilet tissue or whatever.
Do you think that some of them were fake or
not? Yeah, I don't know. It's weird.
I mean... Yeah, if you were, let's say you had a habit of eating tissue, would you really tell your parents? Like, wouldn't, if that was your secret thing?
Yeah.
Let alone a television show.
Yeah. I
mean, because they would, obviously anyone else would say, don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, but then, like, it's so embarrassing that I've watched this show, but they, at the end of the episode, they, like, take them to a doctor.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it's all fake, but.
Right, and they show all the
and
tissue
they show,
paper in their
like,
system.
You know, basically, like, is there going to be a harmful. You know, reaction. Like, there's one woman that I saw that was, like, washed herself with bleach constantly, and so they bring her to a dermatologist.
You mean
something.
Her skin?
Yeah, like, okay. She'd be in the bath and, like, washing herself with bleach all the time. And, you know, and the dermatologist is like, you know, that's a poison, it's getting into your body, like, you know, you have these high levels of whatever, like, you need to stop doing it. So, I don't know, people are weird. I feel like it's not... You know, it does seem like, in a way, in our society, like, if not everyone is addicted to something, everyone at least is connected to somebody that is addicted to something.
For sure. I mean, I don't know. I'm sort of, you know, My Strange Addiction, those are so anomalous, sort of what the things are.
Right,
that
yeah.
But yes, I do think that is true of the society we live in, you know, whether it's work or internet. You know, I went to the acupuncturist this morning, and... It was, I'd never been there before, and they made you do all these weird things where you had to stretch your leg in this certain position, and then the needles, and I was almost having a panic attack being not able to look at my phone.
Oh, interesting.
And
I
thought, this is how you get diagnosed. This is what they're talking about when they're talking about that addiction.
Yeah, no, I totally, I think that, you know, being a, I mean, I think almost everybody is addicted to, like, distraction now, like, and sort of the phone and the TV and the, you know,
and the Facebook.
Yeah, right, all the social networking stuff.
You're good with that. You don't get that into that even.
No, not that into that. But I know, but I mean, I do the thing with my email, like we've talked about that, where it's like, you know, you get a little like surge of, you know, endorphins when you get like a email from certain people.
Oh, dopamine. And yeah.
So I'll like email like my agent, you know, just like an innocuous question, just to get an email from
that's
them.
That's hilarious,
so that
really.
I'll just like, be like, oh, it's exciting, it's from them, and then it's like nothing, but at least I get that little like boost of.
But have you ever had the totally sad thing that I've had where you email yourself a picture or something like that, and you go, woo, and you feel the dopamine rise, and you go, oh, it was me.
Yeah, it was me, yeah, totally, that's happened to me before, too. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, now we have a question from Twitter.
Okay.
It says, how should I react to an addict friend who went through my stuff and stole my prescription drugs?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, if it were me, I guess, and I was going through that with somebody, I feel like, you know, I would probably cut, I mean, I not like, I would probably cut that person out of my life until right. they got treatment. I mean, I think that,
right. But I mean, obviously if it happened to you, you have all this experience with addiction and so you would, you know what to say, but what if it's, I mean, it's kind of hard to say, but if yeah. it's someone who doesn't.
Yeah, no, I mean,
and maybe they don't want to say to that person, hey.
Yeah, no, it's totally a complicated situation. I mean, I understand it's super awkward and stuff too, but well, like when, I mean, I guess it's hard to take it away from myself, but
right.
when I had a friend of mine a few years ago that I found out, like I went on a hike with him, and he was like reaching to get a dog bag out of his pocket, and a needle fell out on the ground. And at first I was like, even like trying to make up excuses for him, you know, I was like, oh, maybe like his aunt is a diabetic, or I don't know. I was like trying not to look in the face, like what right. actually was going on. But you know, then once I kind of realized that, and I, you know, went up to him afterwards, and I,
after the hike,
yeah, I think I like went home or something, and then I came back to like see him afterwards, and I was like, you know, because I was trying to figure out what to do, and you know, I said, you know, I really want to help you any way I can, you know, get you into treatment, like if you need help, you know, putting down payment for it or just getting a referral or whatever, like, you know, but I, you know, and I'm sorry, but I just can't like be around you while you're using. I mean, it's just,
right.
You know, and I think beyond it being, even if I wasn't an addict and it wasn't dangerous for me, I feel like, for someone who's struggling with addiction to have a friend say to them like, I can't be around you until you agree to get sober, it just maybe will help them to realize that, like, you know, this is a problem, this is affecting me, and you know, it gives them like a consequence that is
right.
Maybe valuable. And
well, and it's like what you said about your dad not
exactly.
being codependent with you is what saved your life.
Yeah, I think, and so right, so if it's a friend, if I'm saying like, you know, you need to stop doing this, but I'm going to keep hanging out with you and being your, I mean, I'll still be his friend, but you know, I'm going to keep hanging out with you and acting like, you know, we're just buddy buddy going to a movie or whatever, it doesn't, I feel like it's like, you know, it's sort of enabling in
right.
a way. So, you know, I think it, as hard as it is to draw that line, and I, you know, and I think that's actually something that I always tell people is that, you know, I think there's a tendency to feel like the addict is going to think like, oh, they don't love me anymore. Oh, they are not my friend anymore. But like when my dad said that to me, I never thought like, oh, my dad doesn't love me. I just thought like he loves me and he wants what's best for me and this is what he thinks is going to help me. I mean, I knew that then, and you know, if it had been a friend that was doing that, and it would have been the same thing. I would never have thought like, oh, they don't like me anymore. I would have thought like they're doing this because they're trying to help me.
Right.
And even if I didn't want him to do that, I wanted him to say, you
right.
know, come home and I'll feed you or whatever. But you know. Anyway, so yeah, that would be my advice.
That's good advice. That's good advice. So I think that we're done.
All right, awesome.
So thank you so much. People can follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that you tweet all that much,
no.
But at Nick Shep.
Yeah, I tweeted yesterday.
You did?
Yeah, I was upset to find out that Netflix has changed the word cute.
I know. Why
list.
Is everybody so upset about that?
I don't know. I just think it's kind of annoying.
And also, like you wrote on this this season of The Killing.
Yeah,
people should
yeah,
know
that's
that.
True. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, hopefully, you know, if all goes well, then Schizo, my new novel, is going to be out next fall. So that's not that far away.
No, no. Okay. Well, Nick, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah,
that
of course.
Awesome.
Thank
okay.
you, Anna.